the songs were exactly what is appropriate for what I'm sharing. My message will be simply my sheep know my voice, and talking about that simple, beautiful, life-changing gift that we've been given. So the songs and some of Dennis's points, some of Gilbert's comments, the still small voice, we'll be reading that. It just flows together with what I felt led to share on, and that validation was good for my heart. So let's pray before we continue. Our Father in heaven, thank you that you are Father and that you are Shepherd. We are sheep. We recognize our place as such. We are not glorious. We are simply sheep, very dependent on a shepherd, and have a safe, peaceable existence, a good one with you, and fearfully dangerous in a dangerous world without you. The harm we do to ourselves and how wrong we can be, except for you and your care and guidance, and then all is well in your sheepfold. God, we want to avail ourselves to come to you. Thank you for the gift of drawing, for the gift of being available for us, for your heart of compassion and tender care towards your children. I pray that that would come through today. The message that you would have for your people, for me, would be clear and life-giving from you. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so before I get to the passage where I want to read in John 10, I'd like to start with Elijah as well. Dennis mentioned it, but I'd like to read 1 Kings 19. A story that we're quite familiar with, I'm sure, but I'll go there. So 1 Kings 19, fairly long, but I'd like to read some of this. So 1 Kings 19, if you want to follow along, it's where it's right after Mount Carmel. Elijah had a tremendous victory externally. There was a lot happening. He was a mighty man of God in his day, in the people's eyes, probably to some degree in his eyes. It was a great day in Israel, where finally the showdown had been, the drought is ended that they've been plagued with, and it looks like a good chapter 18 looked like a super chapter. And then it goes into verse 9 or chapter 19, and Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, and with all he had slain all the prophets with the sword. And Jezebel sent a messenger unto Elijah directly, messenger from her to him, saying, so let the gods do to me and more also, if I make not thy life as the life of one of them tomorrow about this time. So the people of my priests that you slain, if you're not like that, let the gods do so to me, said the queen, the most powerful figure, even more powerful, I think, than the king was. And when he saw that, he arose and went for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongeth to Judah, and left his servant there. And he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came down and sat down under a juniper tree, and he requested for himself that he might die. So it's from a seriously high point to a really, really low point. He requested for himself that he might die and said, it is enough now, Lord, take my life away, for I am not better than my father. So he's feeling very human, very needy, very weak. I don't know if he was worn out, but he's very tired, very discouraged. So as he lay and slept under a juniper tree, behold, the angel touched him and woke him up and said unto him, arise and eat. And he looked, and behold, there was a cake baking on the coals and a cruse of water at his head. And he did eat and drink and lay him down again, and he slept again. And the angel of the Lord came the second time and touched him and said, arise and eat, because the journey is too great for thee. And he arose and did drink. And I'll skip forward a bit. Oh, no, I won't. And he came thither unto a cave and lodged there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him. And he said, the Lord said unto him, what doest thou here, Elijah? So the angel was sent twice. He ministered to him. He rested. He ate. He rested. He ate again. And then the word of the Lord came to him. And this was his response. And for us, as we've read it, and as I read it yesterday, it didn't strike me at first. But think of this response. This man obviously knew God. This is a conversation. It's not a stranger breaking in or what God are you. There's a very familiar interaction here. Look at this response to this man to his God. And I have said, and he said, I have been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slayed thy prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left. And they seek my life to take it away. So he's obviously familiar with conversing and God's heart, and they understand each other. There's a touch there. And he said, God said, go forth, stand upon the mountain before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains and break in pieces the rocks before the Lord. So if you ever tried to break a rock, there's a lot involved. There's a lot of force. And it says the mountain, it rent the mountain and break in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind was an earthquake, and the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still, small voice. So why this, not a progression, I guess, but a regression, maybe, if that's a word. Why this? What's he saying here? And it was so, when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entering of the cave. And behold, there came a voice. So the second time he's being talked to. Unto him and said, what doest thou here, Elijah? And he gives a copy and paste answer. It's exactly the same answer as verse 10. Copy and paste. I've been very jealous for the Lord of hosts, and so on. And now they seek my life, and there's nobody left. And the Lord said unto him, and being that the context is what it is, I used to read this with a command voice from God. But somehow, when I read it yesterday, it came to me that this was probably a command with a comfort voice, which is a very different thing. And the Lord said, go thy way to the wilderness of Damascus. When thou comest, anoint. And he gives him instructions. And in verse 21, he returned back from him. I'm in a different context. But he departed thence and went back. So just this brief snapshot of a man of God communing with his God, being encouraged, hearing his voice, fellowship, back and forth, familiar fellowship, even more so. And then going to Mark, I've been reading the book of Mark recently, and a few things I noticed go together here. So in Mark 1, where Jesus enters the scene here, it's not like Luke where they start when he was born, but he just enters here on his baptism occasion, where it talks of John a bit. And then it goes to where Jesus enters in. He says here, John says, I've baptized you with water, but he, the one he's foretelling, will come with the Holy Ghost. And it came to pass in those days that Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized of John in Jordan. And straightway, coming up out of the water, he saw the heavens opened and the Spirit like a dove descending on him. In a different place, it says John saw it. So whether it's Jesus or John in this case, in a different place it says John, but there it was visible. And there came a voice from heaven saying, thou art my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. So those words tell you a lot about God, and they tell you a lot about the Son, and they tell you even more about the relationship. That at that pivotal moment where he enters into his ministry, these are maybe the christening words, thou art my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. And that was the start of Jesus's ministry. So think of that relationship, that touch, that personal, familiar, loving, gracious, I am on your side, all that comes with it. Just hold that there as well. And then later on, he's tempted. Jesus is tempted. He selects a few of his disciples. And in verse 35, just one more verse here. In the morning, rising up a great while before day, he went out and departed into a solitary place and there prayed. So as you think of praying, sometimes we can pray and project prayers. I need this, I need that. Thank you for this, thank you for that. It's the personal aspect is maybe missing, and we're saying prayers or giving prayers or projecting prayers. I don't think Jesus did that. I believe it was a fellowship and a talking and a communication, I think, is how he prayed in light of how he was and what he said and what he taught. So my text is John 10, and my title is simply, My Sheep Know My Voice. Very simple and dear concept. So as we look at the backdrop of men of God doing things for God, whatever situation they're in with Elijah, he gets that touch and that familiar interaction with his God, Jesus as well. So in John 10, Let me read the chapter, or a part of it, I guess. So verily, verily, I say unto you, he that entereth not by the door into the sheepfold, but climbeth up some other way, the same is a thief and a robber. But he that entereth in by the door is a shepherd of the sheep. To him the porter openeth, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calleth his own sheep by name, and leads them out. And when he putteth forth his own sheep, he goeth before them, and his sheep follow him, and then for they know his voice. And a stranger will they not follow, but will flee from him, for they know not the voice of strangers. This parable spake Jesus unto them, but they understood not what things they were which he spoke unto them. Then said Jesus unto them, verily, verily, I say unto you, I am the door of the sheep. All that ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved. He shall go in and out and find pasture. The thief cometh not but for to steal, to kill, and to destroy. I am come that they might have life, and that they might have it more abundantly. I am the good shepherd, and the good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. But he that is an hireling and not a shepherd, whose own the sheep are not, seeing the wolf coming, leaveth the sheep and fleeth, and the wolf catcheth them and scattereth the sheep. The hireling fleeth, because he is a hireling, and careth not for the sheep. I am the good shepherd, and know my sheep, and have known of mine. As the Father knoweth me, even so know I the Father, and lay down my life for the sheep. And other sheep have I, which are not of this fold, them also must I bring, and they shall hear my voice, and there shall be one fold, and one shepherd. Therefore doth my Father love me, because I lay down my life, that he might take it again. No man taketh it from me, but I lay it down of myself. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it again. This commandment have I received of my Father. So in verses 1 to 5, you have the parable, and 7 to 18, the explanation. So Jesus spoke in parables. He was talking about sheep, and he was talking about sheepfolds, but he was talking about reality and life, and he was talking about the disciples that were following him. So it's applicable to them, and it's applicable to us. So very simply, point number one, all of us and all of mankind are sheep. I think that's very simple. We can get that out. Point number two, all of the sheep are somewhere. So all of us are sheep on earth, and all of the sheep are somewhere. And number three, the somewhere is either in the sheepfold or not in the sheepfold. So all of us are sheep. All of us are somewhere. You, me, everybody, somewhere. It's in Jesus' sheepfold or not in Jesus' sheepfold. Very simple points to take from that. So when he talks about this particular sheepfold, there's many folds, I'm assuming. But in his specific one singular sheepfold, there's criteria. Those that are in and those that are not. But he's talking about his specific sheepfold that he's taking care of. And he's giving them the situation. So like he said, if somebody approaches it in the dark or in the daytime and attempts to climb over the wall or come through the back window, there's an obvious problem. I think we all get that fairly easily. So if somebody approaches it any other way, Jesus says they're a thief. And he that climbeth up some other way, in verse 1, the same as a thief and the robber, but he that entereth in by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the porter openeth. So somebody's there keeping the barn or the sheepfold. The shepherd walks up and says, hey, I'm here, open. Open the gate, let them out. The porter, whoever is controlling the gate, opens it up. And the sheep hear that voice and saying, he's here, good morning. And the sheep know that voice, and he leads them out. And when putting forth, take him out in the morning, he goeth before them, and the sheep follow him, and they know his voice. So they know the voice of God. That'll be the main theme here. In verse 7, I'll skip forward to his, he changes things a little bit. So in the top part, he says, he that entereth not by the door into the sheepfold. And then further on in his explanation, he says in verse 9, I am the door. So Jesus wouldn't be entering into the door. Like, it breaks down a little bit, but in the explanation, he goes to that. So inside the shelter, this flock has one thing in common. Everybody inside Jesus' sheepfold have one thing in common. And if you go to a gun club, everybody there, you can ask them, so what are you shooting? Are you familiar with the 243 so-and-so? What are your groupings? And there'll be conversation that's all fitting this category. But Jesus says, in my sheepfold, there is one common thing. The one common thing is that the sheep know the shepherd's voice. And he keeps saying that. So as you would go into that sheepfold, and if sheep could talk, you can say to them, how did you get in here? And everybody in that particular barn or stone fence or whatever it is, they would all say, I came in through the door. How did you get here? I came in through the door. How did you get here? I came in through the door. So if there's 500 sheep in there, every single one of them would have had to come through the door because they're in. And by definition, that's it. That's the only way in. So that's what Jesus is saying here. I am the door of the sheep. Anybody that knows God, that is in Jesus' sheepfold, there is no plan B. So if there's different competing religions or anything besides the simplicity and the blood of Jesus Christ, and we know that, but it's a dear, simple truth, there is no other way. And those that are in have found that way, period. That's all there's to it. And they can relate. They understand. I came through the door. I saw the markings. It swung the same way. They understand that. They can identify with that. He says, I am the door. By me, I skip forward to verse 9. If any man enter in, he shall be saved. He shall go in and out. In Matthew 11:25, he was talking to people that would not listen. They would not repent. They gave him conflict. They pushed back against what he said. They tried to trick him. So in Matthew 25, after what Jason shared here, he was saying, woe to you. You're not listening. You're not repenting. Woe to you, Capernaum. You shall be brought down. If thy mighty works had been in Sodom, it would have remained. They would have heard me. So he's giving strong language to them. But I say unto you that if it be more tolerable for the end in the land of Sodom and the day of judgment than for thee, because I have called and you have not listened. And at that time Jesus said, Father, I thank thee, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because thou hast hid these things from the wise and prudent and hast revealed them unto babes. So it is a gift from God to be able to see these things. Even so, Father, for it seemed good in thy sight, all things are delivered unto me of my Father. And no man knoweth the Son but the Father, and neither knoweth any man the Father save the Son, and to he whomsoever the Son will reveal him. So the way to the Father is through Jesus Christ. There is no other way, and this is a beautiful invitation. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. And the question is, laboring from what? Rest from what? Come unto me, all ye that labor, heavy laden, I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. You've been tired, you've been working, you've been pulling, and you're done. Learn of me. I am meek and lowly in heart, and you shall find rest unto your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. So those that have come through Jesus Christ have found this. They found an easy yoke. They found the shepherd that is meek and lowly in heart, and they found rest for their soul. And I think there's a place of growing and getting light, and I don't know where that line is. And some people are really burdened by their sin and really, really sick and are groaning for a long time. And I had a lot of baggage when I came to God, and I desperately needed rest. But some people maybe don't have as much of that. But I think for everybody, there has to be a place of you seeing yourself, who you are without God. And that is a fearful thing if God reveals that. I fear where I would be without God, literally. Not overstating it. I fear what I would be without God, where I would be and what I would be. So have you been weary and heavy laden? Has your soul needed rest? And then have you found rest? So the burden of yourself, your sin, and your soul, of who you are without God, it is not a good thing. When we see ourselves truly, man is corrupted and man is fallen. We are not good. So at John 3, just to touch on that a little bit more, very familiar passage again. John 3, 1 to 21. I could read all of it, but I think I'll keep moving. But some of it here, the verses that we know very well, probably one of the most quoted verses in the Bible. 3, For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. For God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, but the world through him might be saved. So if God declares us needing to be saved, we definitely need to be saved. It's a right diagnosis. He that believes on him is not condemned, but he that believeth not is condemned already, because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. And that was Jesus' frustration, if I can say it that way, back in the other passage when he talked to them and gave them the woe, will you not hear me? And then it says here, they would not come to him because their deeds were evil and they loved darkness rather than light. And without God there is darkness, and with God there is light. He that doeth the truth comes to the light, that his deeds may be made manifest, for they are wrought in God. So that simple concept of coming to God with our needs, whatever they are, be it salvation or anything else that we need from him, from then forward. So are you an okay person? It's hard to gauge, because what is the gauge? How we feel inside, how we compare, what do we go by? Somebody that has deteriorating eyesight often doesn't know it, or most of the time doesn't know it, because the standard keeps moving with them. I can see, I think, as clearly as I did yesterday. I took eye surgery like 5 or 6 years ago, and I think I see the same, but I have not checked my eyes since then one time, and I thought sometimes I should, because I think I see clearly, but it might have regressed by 70%, or 30%, sorry, I might be only seeing 70% of what I should, but how do I know, unless I see something else to gauge it off of? So when I go to the optometrist and he's saying, no, 20/20 is this way, and you're all the way back here, you need some help. So when we say, are you an okay person, when we look at the life of Jesus Christ and who he is, and some of the Beatitudes and some of his teachings, it's a good alignment for us. So in Christ, I am beautiful and good. In me, I am awful. And that's the truth. So being saved from ourself is needed. So Paul's testimony in Galatians 2:20, the life that I live by the faith of the Son of God. And yet not I, but Christ lives in me. So if there's beauty, value, goodness, it's from Jesus. If it's carnal, it's from me. It's pretty much that simple. We need God. So in 7-9, when he says, I am the door, God's children understand those things. They understand what it means to need God. They understand what it means to come to him. And there's fellowship there and a common agreement. We're in the sheepfold and we came through the door because we needed the door. We needed that statement of, I am the door, come unto me. So back to the parable in verses 3 and 4 in John, where he says, to him the porter openeth, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calleth his own sheep by name, and he leads them out. Think of Elijah. Did Elijah know his God? His response was familiar, right? He knew him. Think of Jesus. Was it a strange, shocking thing to Jesus to hear, this is my beloved son? It was a completely natural interchange. He knew him. It was not strange to him. So those touches by a God is, I think, what God is after. God does not want the mechanical, duty-bound, autopilot Christianity, I think, from what I can read and understand. So is our God approachable, number one? So if there's something in what I've noticed in my life when I think of it, what keeps me from doing well with God spiritually? It is almost always insecurity with me, my failings, and in short, me. So God is always good. God is always benevolent. God doesn't change that. But if there's something blocking, it's usually me or something I did or something I feel. If I could simply get away from me and come to God with just who he is, that bridge is often hard to process. But in verse 3, he says, the sheep hear his voice, and he calleth his own sheep. And these two words here bring a different element altogether. It's one thing to call something. It's another one to call them by name. and another altogether in that context to lead them out. So God has given every indication of benevolence. So I have a silly dog. I have two dogs, and I had three. I had a dog growing up. His attitude towards me was basically, I like being with you. And I'd milk cows. We had three shifts of milking cows. We didn't do it twice. We milked three times a day. So my shift would fall to the evening, which I really liked. So around 12 or 1 in the morning, I'd be finished. The barn is cleaned. Everything's tidy. The milk is cooling. And I'm done. And I don't have to get up in the morning early because I work night shift, kind of. So I'd go for a walk or a bike ride with my dog. And he'd be so excited when I come out in the evening at 12:30 usually. He'd be bouncing and skipping every day at the front of the cow barn. Just thrilled to be there. We are going for a walk and I love being with you. That was what he said every evening. And I got out of the barn and I was reading Jeremiah at the time a fair bit. And the response, and I don't mean to be sacrilegious or crude here, but my natural owner and liking my dog response was, I will be your human and you will be my dog. And I said that to him probably 50 times, many times. But it burst out of me. Thanks for being here, dog. We're going for a walk. I like your company. And I said to him audibly as I came out in a laughing voice, I will be your human and you will be my dog. And I'm not putting negative on or crassness on Jeremiah, where God always says often, I will be your God and you will be my people. But that heart came out of me. And I just told him and I appreciated that he would be there. So that's one dog. I have another dog that's silly and she keeps running away. And yesterday I went to the neighbor and got her again for like the 10th time the last 2 months. And she knows she's not supposed to be there. So when she sees my car driving, it's like, oh no, here he is. And it's like, I shouldn't be here. I know I shouldn't be here. What am I doing here? And she's hiding. And I pick her up and put her in the car, take her home. She gets her due diligence, which is, I encourage her not to go. I'll say it that way. And I lock her up for a week. And I take her off the collar. 15 minutes later, hi, Jason, your dog is here. Okay, a week later, I go get her again. And we keep doing that. We have this cycle. So when she's home, she's on the ground. I actually like her. She's a dear little beagle. But when she's on the ground and I say, hey, Tessa, come here. She'll be like, me. And she will not come to me. I can tell everything in her. The dog wants to. The dog in her, she's her tail is wagging kind of, and she looks, and I'd like to, but she can't. She will not come because Tessa is in the way. I want to be with her. I want to give her comfort. I want to thump her ribs. I want to ruffle her ears. I like her. I would genuinely want her to come over. I don't care about last night. I do to a degree, but it's done. I mean, you ran away, so be it. Come here, dog. I want to be with you. And she'll be 10 feet off and will not come, though she'd love to come, because she's in the way. But if she could get beyond herself to just what I feel, and I'm calling her, come here, dog. Like, forget about yesterday. Just forget about you. Come here. She would not come. She still doesn't come, over and over. So I go to her, and I give her attention. And her other dog, when she does something wrong, Millie, it's like she does something wrong, she'll chew something or bring a dead and rotten turkey home from the fields. And it's like, I can tell her in stern tones, Millie, don't do that. And she hears that her ear is going out and she's very sorry and all the standard dog things. But if I call her, even though I just scolded her soundly, she'll still come, sheepish, tail down, slinking. But it's like, I'm your dog, right? I'm your dog, right? I'm your dog, right? I'm coming. And she'll come. And we're good. So those are three attitudes. One is just happy to be with me, fellowship. One is shrinking. I know I shouldn't have displeased you. I don't think you like me. Maybe you're going to do it again. Mistrust. And one is a kind of a, yeah, I know I did wrong, but I'm coming. So of the three dogs, what do you think would be my favorite as a dog owner? What do you think? The first one. I just like a dog that wants to be with me. And I spanked him properly many times. Like he'd do stuff that he shouldn't. But generally, he'd want to be with me. And when I don't mean to be crude. I'm just putting it out as illustrations. Where do you find yourself? And for me, I am most often like the middle one that would love to come if it wasn't for me. But how do you get across that feeling of he can't like me because I know I've run away like 10 times and I know he didn't like it when I did. But how do you bridge that? You bridge that by looking at who's calling. If Tessa could get beyond what she's feeling and what she's sensing and what she thinks I'm going to think about her, to me, I'm calling you. Come. I want you here. I legitimately do. I like you. So if we can look beyond ourselves to him, that's the key. If we look beyond ourselves to him. So there's a poem I said many times in my preaching from many years ago. I found it, and the way it's worded is, it's written in poem form. So there's like, I came crawling, the next line is through the desert, but I came crawling through the desert with my cup for water. If only I had known you better, I would have come running with a bucket. I love that poem. I came crawling through the desert with my cup for water. If only I had known you better, I'd have come running with a bucket. So back to the parable here. When he putteth forth his own sheep, he goeth before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. And the sheep hear his voice, and he calleth them by name, and he leadeth them out. Those are God's sheep. That is the shepherd. So can we look beyond ourselves, past the insecurity, past the failing, past ourselves to who he is? He calls us by name. Can we go, can we learn to go, as it says in Hebrews, what we looked at a while back, when he invites, he made a way, he did everything he could. In Hebrews, can we learn to go? Can we learn to trust the shepherd? Can we learn to trust the shepherd? And then what I want to touch on the most here and getting to this is, can we learn to listen? So can we learn to go, number one? Can we learn to trust, number two? But number three, and most important, I think, I mean, the other two are important. You have to go and you have to trust. But can we learn to listen? Now, this is from anybody from age 10 that or young that can go to God. And I talked to God when I was young, before I was born again. I talked to him and he listened. And I felt that in places I did have direct communication and touch from God when I was young. And he heard me. Can we learn to listen at any age? And how are we governed? The other day I was listening to Focus on the Family and a marriage thing. I was driving, picking up parts for a bus or something with a school van, and listening to Focus, and there was this marriage thing, and this person was talking about how God spoke to him about loving his wife. And all of a sudden, there was like a serious prick of bang. That hit me. It went inside in a way that few things do. It's like, it was so odd that it went so direct that I wondered, why is that so direct? It almost hurt. So if you think of a chink in the armor, there's a story that after what Heiko read last week, where somebody fired the arrow. I think it's 2 Kings. I'm not going to go there, but somebody fired the arrow, and they hit the king. Fired the arrow at random, and they hit the king between. It says between the chink in the armor. So as they would have had these plates, whatever it was, they were heavier and thick, whether it was thick leather or metal or whatever it was, or chainmail. There's different things that you can put on for armor. It obviously can't be one piece or you'd be stuck, right? You can't move. So there's gaps that overlap. And the same with a hockey goalie suit. There's a plate up here and one that tucks up underneath, so they overlap. But once in a while, if you're out of position, the puck comes in and flies from a different angle. It come up underneath and go underneath the top piece and over top of this one. And it flies up and hits you, and it hurts like crazy because it went between two plates that were covered. But if you angle it a certain way, there's a direct way in. So if you're out of position or you're laying wrong and somebody shoots, you can really, really get hurt because there's a gap. But if you're facing forward properly, you know that anything, they can shoot as hard as they want. It doesn't hurt. It's just a bump. Like anywhere on your body, you know that you're comfortable. It's bunk. It doesn't hurt. But there's a chink in the armor sometimes where you're blue. And I've seen bad spots on different people. I hardly ever get hurt, but some people, especially new ones, they got seriously hurt. But I was thinking, with that penetration of God speaking to me in that time, it was so sharp that I wondered why. It was unusually sharp in that, do I not hear from God enough that this is so deep and so severe? Like, how come I'm so unused to receiving something from God? Do I have armor and this happened to slip through? It's almost what it felt like. And I was surprised, not by receiving it, but does that mean I have armor if I'm not used to it? What's going on? So the thing that God spoke to me on was one thing, but what bothered me was I should be receiving regular input that goes to this place. What's wrong with me that I don't? Was the message I took home from it. Do I have armor that has chinks? Do I need chinks in the armor? Or can I take the armor out? How are we governed? Are we governed like mules with sticks, that you beat them left and you beat them right? Or is it more like a thoroughbred racehorse? If you've ever been on a really fast horse, it's something. We were taking care of horses when I was like 16 or 17 for a professional racer. He would go to the rodeo circuit, and he would drop his horses off at our pasture to take care of. Because we had cows, we just put them out and be along. They wouldn't really cost anything. So in the off times, he'd bring his professional racehorses to our place and drop it off, and we rode them sometimes. So if you're on a horse that knows how to run and loves how to run, he's not bucking you. We had other stubborn beasts that were, they shouldn't have hardly been called horses. They were, you had to haul in the rain, and they constantly wanted to go left, and then on purpose run close to a fence so you rip your feet, or they'd run straight up to it and break so you fall over onto the fence. Like, just crazy. So there's different ways of guiding and governing, but a horse that would love to run and want to run and want to please you, that's a different thing. And as they trot, it's kind of rough. Thuk-a-duk-a-duk, your head shakes, especially not used to it, then it's rough. Your bum bounces the saddle. But then they go to another gear. It's like into drive, and they're fast. It's like a bit rocky. But there's another gear when they put it into overdrive, and they love to run. The wind just starts picking up, and just like, and the fence posts start going tick, 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 next to you till it's a line. And the horse, you can feel it. It's smooth. Its head is out, and it just loves to run. And when you guide it, it just does what you want it to. It's a massive machine, 1,600 pounds or something, flying. And you're a little 17-year-old, 180-pound chap guiding it by touch. It is absolutely amazing. And it's fast and powerful. And thinking of a different illustration, I hauled gravel for a while. And there would be these massive loaders. I had a triaxle trailer, which I forget the tonnage, but something like 20, 30 tons on it, loaded. And these guys would show up with these massive loaders in the gravel pits. And so the bigger loaders, some of them don't have a steering wheel. They just have two sticks about the size of my thumbs. And the guy sitting in an air-conditioned cab, huge cab, like 12 feet up, and he's got these two little sticks. And all he's got, he's moving them like this, forward for tilt, back for up, forward for driving, left for steering. So he's controlling that massive machine with two 3-inch joysticks. And it's amazing. He comes to me, he gives me one bucket, my truck goes, you feel the whole thing. Then he dumps another one, and the truck just shakes, and you're full. So two loads of a loader is like 20, 30 ton, and that machine is guided by joysticks with very little effort, the same it would take to move my thumb. So how are we governed? Are we mules that need to be beaten like the shorter gray horse that we had that would just do the stupidest things and just would not listen and would not learn and try to hurt you and just be obstinate in every way? Or are we the racehorse that can be just guided and work with who's governing you? Or like a loader that can just be moved no matter what its power and strength is, it's being guided completely by some other influence. So in our heart, going back to the chink in the armor, when God talks to us, who are we? What is our response to that? Are we used to? Can we talk to him? Can he guide us? Can he speak to us? Can he speak something and we move? Like, do we even have that capability? Or is it an outward Christianity that we do this and this and this and this? It's a very different concept of an autopilot Christianity of a moral life versus being guided to the law of God by the inside. So there's things we can do that are okay morally, maybe technically. But when God speaks on the inside, there's a finer law at play that's not okay. And I've had some of those things in my life recently where in the older days, maybe even a few months ago, they would have been okay. But God spoke to me in a still voice and said, this is not good. I don't want you doing it. Though morally, there's not a huge bit wrong. Other people might do it. But specifically for you, no. And I found myself moving out to a place of safety, and I was far better off by that guiding voice. So how are we governed? Sometimes God touches on things. Have you ever taken a broom and you swept and you take the broom and you put it in the closet? Except on your way there, it turns a little bit. Then as you go through the door, the broom catches on both ends. It hits the door jamb. and it hits you. You ever done that? It's not fun. Or a hockey stick exiting the rink, and you don't think about your hockey stick, and it's on the boards, and it hits your thighs, and you fall out. That's not graceful. I've done that too. It's not fun. So sometimes when there are things in our life, we're moving, our attitude towards God is, yeah, I can do this, and I'll do what you want, and we're kind of fluid, and we're moving, but he brings a certain specific one, and it's like the hockey stick crosses the door, and it's like, I'm not doing that one. We'll work on this one, this one, this one, this one. But when God brings a specific one that we don't want to deal with, that's probably the one that should be talked about or worked on in our life, the hockey stick goes across the door again, it would look clunk, we're not going there. So are there things in our life that we know that are next on our plate that maybe they've been for 10 years, but I don't want to deal with that? And we work on something else. And when we get to God in honesty, he might say, well, this one, and it's another no. So there's a danger in Christianity to forget God. Alyssa had a wonderful book the other day with a good write-up on it, but I didn't take the time to look it up. But it got my thoughts turning in this direction as well. There's a danger in Christianity to forget God. Isn't that an odd concept? And I know it's true in my life, and I've seen it in others. There's a danger in Christianity to forget God. That is so weird, but so true. So you can defend his existence and have a life defending his existence and forget about his person. You can be ministering in his name because he said, do unto others, and you do it because he said it, but then you focus on the people, and you want your reward from the people that you're serving as opposed to who sent you. So we can be doing his work and looking for the reward with the work instead of the reward from the command. Where do we get our affirmation from? Where do we get our affirmation from? Which good job is the one we need, from the people or from God who told you to do it? Just a quick thing here. Caleb, I was very blessed by the songs, and also Dennis's comments and Gilbert. Somehow they flowed together in such a way that I changed my thing last night to a different vein that I thought I'd go down, and I felt clear to do it. But today during singing, when Caleb said that I felt led to have songs of comfort, and I think he said leading, and I think he said shepherd, just paraphrasing, but God gave me that little prick again. And generally when God speaks to me in that way, I'm not a crier. I don't cry from anything except when God touches me. And I had immediate tears because God touched me here and said, this is what I wanted you to do. So whether I got affirmation from anybody, God today just touched me, and it was so sweet. This is what I wanted to share. It's good. This is, we're still in harmony, still in sync. And that affirmation was enough for, I'm good. If nobody gets anything out of it, I feel God wanted me to share this because he said, check. And it was something that was very ministering to me this morning. So which good job do we need? Which good job are we looking for? And then the next point is the sheep are all part of the family. So there are no two teams in the sheepfold. And sometimes when people have differing views or they go a different direction, the bottom line is that everybody in the sheepfold has to be part of the same sheepfold. So if there's people going astray, they are your fellow sheep, part of being led by the same shepherd, needing correction. They're not the enemy. They're not your rival. They need correction. Maybe we need correction. But there are no enemies in the sheepfold. They're together. If somebody's getting lost in a moral life, in their moral life, or somebody has a different vision, he says there is just one sheepfold and I am the door. So that's the only criteria. So let's not go to autopilot without actually connecting meaningfully with God. One thing that I was thinking of is what would be the gauge, like I said before, how do we determine where we're at? A good one for me that's uncomfortable, I will share this, is I think an actual gauge that's actually accurate would be prayer life. So we can do quite well with church life and quite well with work life and quite well in our social life. But I think that connection with God, if the prayer life is not there, probably the connection is pretty weak. As I think a fairly safe indicator whether we like it or not. Even though it feels like we're doing okay inside, if the prayer life and the time with God, the time to sit and listen and be in tune with God, or even throughout the day, like maybe it's not a set time that you take 2 hours away, but in your day, you have a quiet heart and you're open and receptive to what God is doing with you and for you. It's a connection, even though you're living your normal daily life. So I don't mean necessarily a block of solitary time. That's not exactly what I'm talking about, but connection time with God. So prayer life and time with God. And the other thing I want to touch on as I move on is there's an element of the Christian life that is secret. And that's in a good way and in a bad way, because one day everything's revealed. But I want to talk about the positive for now. In Revelation 2, one of my favorite verses that has ministered to me so many times, Revelation 2:17. In light of this, in light of sheep hearing his voice, in light of working with God, in light of the relationship, Revelation 2:17, where God, speaking of the overcomers, and talking of overcoming, or I'll get to that in a minute. So Revelation 2:17. And to him that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith to the churches. To him that overcometh, I will give to him of the hidden manna. So how is that? What is God giving his children? Inside, it's hidden. It's manna, it's strengthening, it's food. So what is God giving? To him that overcometh, I will give him to eat of the hidden manna. So if there's an inner strength in you, if there's that fellowship there, and you feel strengthened to go about your daily life, that's a gift from God, that's strength for you. And it's not a public wash that just comes in all Christians. It says, to him that overcometh, I will give to eat of the hidden manna, and will give him a white stone, and a stone, a new name written, that no man knoweth, saving he that receiveth it. So I love that personal aspect here. So if you're working on something, the whole world doesn't need to know about it. I mean, it's okay to share, don't get me wrong. But I'm saying it's very important that God knows about it, that you know about it, that we have a place in our heart that's communing with God, and I think constantly working with him to be more Christ-like, that he teaches us, we listen, we apply, and we're guided by his voice inside. So that new stone, somebody that might be an angry person, and God is working with it, can you imagine that feeling of walking through this life of 60, 70 years, working with that frustration in your life of being angry or whatever it is? And I'm not saying we can't move on past things, but if it's something that you're legitimately working on, when you get home and God gives you the name, peace, of what that would do for you, or anything that's an issue in your life, and with God you're working on it, and when you get home, he gives you your name. There is something so personal and sweet about that. I love that verse. So there's an element of the Christian life that's secret in a good way. So are we letting God work in our heart? Or is it like the broomstick that when he touches the thing that should be touched on, the broomstick goes across the door and bang, we're not going in. So the savor, the beauty, and life comes from real communication with our Father. So life can be very dry on autopilot. I know that when I was younger in the early charity days, I was one of the fringe people. I was probably one of the most fringe young people that would wear a red t-shirt and light blue jeans to Bible school when everybody had shirts and khaki slacks. I'd have light jeans and a red t-shirt on purpose. Just, I'm not with you. I'm my own person. I'm independent. I'm not swallowing all your stuff. I just put that statement out. If you look at the pictures, that's me at Bible school. And I lived like that for quite a while. I was probably a year or so, just not sure. My friend and I would go to different churches while people went to Oakville. We'd check out different things. I just was not sold on this stuff necessarily. So, we got an apartment, moved to Arburg. I moved in with a family. I was kind of doing okay, not bad. I wasn't doing awful things, but my life was not serious. And I knew it, and I think everybody else knew it. But at a certain time, before I started courting Alyssa, I don't know, I still like to know before God if it was her prayers that did it, that she felt she should be praying for me, or if I changed and then she noticed me and started praying for me. I don't know. But it was in that similar time frame where I made a serious change in my life inside, because I had the reputation of being, it's just him, very little credibility, just let him do what he wants. He just bought an expensive car. We don't want these kind of cars in church. And it was more, I was more that guy. So for the elders to really respect me and talk with me, it was more, and I felt it, and I saw it. And on one part, I didn't mind because I wanted the car and I wanted those things. But when I changed, I did want it because I was now legitimately in, I felt. But then after that sting of, okay, I made a serious change, I didn't tell anybody. But to me, it felt like it was so big inside of me, everybody should now know, because obviously I'm here with you and I'm coming every week and I sold the car. But I came to a place where God spoke to me and said that if the whole world knows and I don't, no, sorry, if I know and the whole world does not, that's perfectly okay. Let's work, you and I. And I started a journey with God. I learned how to pray. I didn't know how to pray before. I'd literally go under my feather blanket. We had a house that had a lot of people in it. There was very little privacy. So I'd literally go under a feather blanket so nobody could hear me, and I would pray. I would literally groan in prayer, and I've hardly done it since, but I would share my burdens with God that were real, and I learned to talk with him and sit and be quiet for as long as needed before I felt God speaking to me about issues in my life. Not whether I should wear a blue shirt or change jobs, not mystical stuff, just about me and him and the relationship that I have with him. What would you have me change? Because I'm serious about you. And I sought him and I read the word and I was deeply changed inside. And it was, eventually it came out, but I remember that feeling of nobody needs to know, it's completely okay because this is about me and God. And I don't mean that we sink there, because I think as we walk with God, the corporate thing comes together, but we know what it means to walk with God. And my life changed dramatically. But it was inside where it was. I mean, it showed outside, but it happened inside. So the savor of beauty in life comes from real communication with the Father. Life can be very dry and autopilot. So my life changed when I internally changed stuff. Quick story. I told it at a youth meeting a while back, but I read a cute story a while back of a boy who kept tormenting the cat. He was a young guy, maybe 8, 9, but he kept tormenting the cat, and everybody was frustrated with him. And one day he came to his mom and said, "Mom, I gave my heart to God last night, or I gave my heart to God a while ago." And she said, "Really? Does anyone know about this?" And he said, "Well, God knows, and I know." And thought a bit, then he said, "I think the cat knows." So that probably told the mom, okay, this is more to it than just talk. In another story that I've shared before, but I'll say it again. When I was younger, I had tendencies that were maybe a little bit more OCD than I am now. I think I've become a little bit more balanced, but I liked stuff to be in certain ways, and I'd get a little bit obsessive about stuff. So I had a memory stick. When memory sticks were new, I bought one because I liked the latest toys. I bought one, but one day I lost the cap off of it, and my memory stick did not have the cap on it, and it was loose and silver and shining at me every time I used it. I want the cap on it, and there was something stuck in my brain, and eventually I forgot about it. I used the memory stick, but one winter, maybe a month or so later, I had a big John Deere tractor come, like a big machine, come and clear our driveway. It was probably like a 150-horse tractor, a big farm tractor with a bucket. He'd come clear our driveway. So he came and pushed the snow he came in, put his bucket down, pushed the snow in a pile, dumped and left, big machine. And I was going through a bit of a tougher time during that season, and I came home from my truck, and I stepped out onto the snow, and just as I was stepping out just to see where my foot went, I saw that the loader had pushed the snow and gone. My cap was right where I would, like if I would look down where my foot would go, it was literally centered in that area. And the loader had pushed the snow off of my driveway, revealing the cap, but there was such a thin sheet. He missed it. It was still covered, but he missed it by so little. It might have been like a half a millimeter of glazed snow ice on top of it. Like I could see it clearly, as thin as you could go, probably with a spoon, without hitting it and wrecking it forever. So he didn't dig it up and he didn't bury it. It was just like a half a millimeter of glaze over it. And it was right there, protected, safe, right where I'd step. And that's might be coincidental. It might have been coincidental. But I took that touch. God spoke to me then. And again, I teared up because I sensed that he said, God basically said, "Here's your cap back. How else would we do this? The loader showed it to you. And I took that simple thing as a touch, and it was. God reassured me, he loved me, and I had hope and faith to process what I was doing. So without that working together, and for you that would might be nothing, but at the time it was important to me. But without that personal touch, it was such a hope-giving thing because somebody knows me to do that for me. Like you could never have figured that out, but God knew. He knew my inner heart and gave me that, what I wanted. For you, nothing. For me, big. And today now it wouldn't hardly do anything either, but it fit me then. That's the point. So without that hope-giving personal touch, it's hard to grow if you're just living with a moral life. I should do this. I should not do that. So Jesus went apart to a place of solitude and he prayed. As we read before, if he needed it and it was dependent on that, how is it possible that we would live healthily without that? So if Jesus needed to go apart and pray, how is it possible that we would live a safe, happy, healthy Christian life without it? What is our health like? So 1 second at a time, just wrapping up here, 1 second at a time leads to a day and then a week. And 1 second, stack, 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 leads to a decade, a millennia. 1 second, so insignificant. But I believe the walk with God is simply this. We walk with God till we're home. So I think we walk with God till we're home. And the thing is, though, I've seen people close to me, and even me, being godly today, doing well today, does not mean I'm doing godly by next Friday, or be godly by next Thursday, or in 10 days from now, and for sure not in a month. Christianity is not a finished deal. I think we need to walk with God daily to be safe. So if you're doing well on Sunday, you probably know that Monday is not guaranteed. But if you walk with God, then it's okay. It's not an autopilot thing. So we're not enemies. So I'd just like to quick read the passage again. I kind of went through it without reading it, so I'll read it in closing. I had a few more things, but I'll leave them. But in my life, there's been situations where I've been right. And once in a brother's meeting, I got up and I stated a strong opinion that was technically right. A brother came over, older brother, and said, you know, Jason, I would not have said it that way. Then I said, but I'm right. It was so-and-so-and-so-and-so, right? He said, yes, but I would have not have said it that way. And I remember that feeling of stiffness inside of me, but I'm right. And I didn't take anything what he said. Now, he was very right. I should not have said it that way. That's not your place. Sit down, son. So even though it was right, that was not wrong. Had I listened to that voice that I should have listened to, I said, what's he saying? Is there humility missing here? God would have told me then, sit down. That's not your place. But I didn't take it. I remember that resistance of I'm right instead of sit down. So when I say listen to God's voice, like I said, I don't mean go to your closet, what shirt to wear, blue, red, ooh. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking of working with God on issues that we have. And sometimes he might touch on something that we may or may not understand. Quick closing story here, but I have a friend that's a pilot. He flies commercially, and he told me a story a number of years ago. When he was starting out, he was doing a routine flight, climbing from an airport, heading south, the direction I'm looking, and radio control cleared him. He took off. He was climbing, and the radio tower told him whatever his call letters were, so-and-so and so-and-so, whatever, A7. 6-5, we need you to do 270 bearing west, which, again, my language is kind of wrong, but I'll make the point. So in a 360 degrees, you're full circle, 90 degrees is right. So a 270 would be like this, right? So they said 270 bearing west, and he was kind of new, and he wasn't sure what it would mean, but he got the bearing west. Okay, 270, it doesn't make sense. I'm heading south, I need to go west, okay. Then he started edging west, and then immediately air traffic came on and said, whatever his call was, AC-740, did you read? Did you copy? And he said, yes, I'm heading west. Then he said, we said, do it 270 bearing west. Can you please follow instructions? Then he said, repeat. He said, do a 270 bearing west. So to him, he's flying this way. They want him west. So in his mind, I am. And he's new and he's frustrated and he's climbing and he's got other stuff to deal with. But then he said, so-and-so call letter, A7-270, you need to do a 270 bearing west. You're heading into the path of the approaching WestJet, so-and-so. So another plane is coming this way. He's crossing the path. and they said, get out of the way, do a 270. So what they wanted him to do, instead of bearing west, was loop around, out of the way, and once he's passed, you're coming behind him. But he didn't get that. But air traffic knew it. You've got a 737 coming, and you've got this little mail plane cruising across the path. They said, do a 270 bearing west. Like, do what we say. Because to him, it didn't make sense. Why would he? But then he went out of the way, made the loop around, and then went west like he should have. But if you don't see that, how can you process that? And you have a crash that you never saw coming because you don't see everything. So when God says things, we need to recognize that in our finite mind. I really appreciated the thing Dennis read in closing. If it doesn't make sense to us, it is very, I'll say it's stupid to say that I'm not going to do it because I don't understand it. That is so tiny-minded. We cannot do that. So if God speaks something, it's important. Take it. So if your tower says something you can't quite compute, but it's clear instruction, we'd be best to heed it because you don't know the crash that's coming. It makes sense to you. I need to go west, right? Right, yeah. But no, we didn't say head west. We said 270 west. So heed the voice of God in your life. And it'll be things to do with your heart and his. And if there's bigger things, as in go talk to somebody, maybe that's needed. But that's not quite what I'm talking about. God revealed that you have sinned, and I don't mean those things. So not a mystical, mysterious, ultra-spiritual, simply being guided and taught by fellowship with the Father and the Shepherd. My sheep hear my voice and call, follow my call. Can we, in closing, sing 169? I'd just like to read some of the words that I always... looking at 169. Caleb, can you come up, please, when I'm done? So 169, there are some such beautiful words here. My soul he doth restore again, and me to walk doth make within the paths of righteousness. His leading will never lead us astray, even for his own name's sake. Yea, though I walk through death's dark veil, yet will I fear no ill, if that voice is there. And imagine going home, if you knew that you were going home to heaven, for some reason you have your death foretold, it wouldn't be such a terrifying thing if you've talked to that same God an hour ago, like legitimately communicated with him, and then I'm coming home, as opposed to being tuned out for the last few months maybe or week. It's different. But if you know him, you can go to him. So God's mercy, goodness and mercy shall all my life surely follow me, and in God's house forevermore my dwelling place shall be. Caleb, can you come up?